I'm Joyce Pillarella. This is number 0629, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0629. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we remember seven-time Emmy-winning actor Ed Asner, who starred as Lou Grant on both the classic sitcom The Mary Tyler Moore Show and the hour-long drama Lou Grant. Ed Asner died at the end of August at the age of 91. We feature part of a conversation with him from 1995, including reminiscing about winning his first Emmy.
First night back on Mary Tyler Moore in the second year, I was waiting in the wings, having won my first Emmy with Gavin and Ted. And as they played the music for us to make our running entrance onto the stage, I looked at them and my heart was bursting, and I said, boy, I could die now. And they looked at me as if I was nuts. You go ahead. We have yet to win ours.
Jay Van Bavel is the author of The Power of Us, which explores the dynamics of shared social identities, including conspiracy theories.
Conspiracy theories are people putting a bunch of dots together to make sense of something that's confusing. And I will say, you know, during elections, or especially now during the pandemic, there's a lot of uncertainty. The situation is quite dangerous. People are looking to make sense of all of that in their own way through their life. And now with the internet and social media, you can kind of find almost any evidence for any belief system that you want with the right search words and following the right people. So it allows people to really go down this rabbit hole and also tap into a community of like-minded others.
Clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber, the CEO and founder of TripSitter Clinic, is back to talk about stress and mental health in these trying times, and how his clinic harnesses the power of psychedelics.
If you're really anxious, really depressed, or suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, you're first of all not thinking clearly. There's a lot of hurdles to overcome. We capitalize on low-dose use of ketamine because now it allows people to lower their self-defense mechanisms, so now we can get in there therapeutically and work on things that they're not trying to stop because they've allowed us to kind of disinhibit their defense mechanisms for a 30 or 45-minute window.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater. The person who told you that this was show number 0629 was Joyce Pillarella, who is an oral historian, author, and urban explorer right here in Montreal. Thank you very much, Joyce, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? According to a Tennessee Highway Patrol trooper, when I pulled up behind him and turned on my lights, he then took off and refused to stop. The trooper is referring to is 39-year-old Tyson Gilbert. At one point, Gilbert, who led the chase down Highway 70, stopped and opened his car door to reveal he was wearing absolutely nothing and was covered in blood. Said Trooper Bobby Johnson, he then shut his door and kept driving. After two sets of spike strips failed to stop Gilbert, the cops finally boxed him in and got him stopped. That's when Gilbert told Trooper Johnson what happened. Voices on his car radio told him to cut off his manhood in order to save the world. He did what he was told, throwing it out of the car's window. He was taken to a hospital. Well, speaking as someone who has spent the better part of 40 years talking to people over their car radios, when you hear someone say to cut off your manhood in order to save the world, it's time to change the station, or better yet, just turn off the radio. Yeah. Monsignor Stephen Rossetti of Washington, D.C. is an exorcist and licensed psychologist and counselor who is warning Catholics that demons have figured out how to send threatening text messages to their targets. Rossetti claims to have three cases in which demons have texted the team and/or the family of the possessed person. All were high-value targets with high-ranking, powerful demons involved. For example, one text read, "Her torments start now, priest, all night. We will make her bleed." Rossetti points to a long history of demons influencing technology such as flickering lights and TVs. Oh, for the love of God! Have you ever heard such bunk? I mean, this is just complete and utter bullsh—
We're sorry. We're experiencing technical difficulties. Please stand by. This has nothing to do with the devil. It's just a coincidence. Besides, Satan has more pressing issues to deal with other than cheap parlor tricks. He's got bigger fish to fry, or is that?
What was that? Suddenly everything went dark and cold for a moment, then hot. Anyway, let's get to our first segment, shall we, here on this edition of the Stuff File program, while we still can. Ooh. Television has lost another giant of the industry. 7-time Emmy-winning actor Ed Asner, who starred as Lou Grant on both the classic sitcom The Mary Tyler Moore Show and the hour-long drama Lou Grant, died at the end of August. He was 91. Back in May of 1995, I had the chance to talk to Ed when he was promoting the short-lived ABC sitcom that he was working on at the time called Thunder Alley. Here is part of that conversation now.
The one thing I'd like to start off with is the fact that you have had an interesting career and where you've had a chance to do both comedy and drama, in some cases with the same character. That doesn't happen very often. How do you answer to the fact that you have quite a rare thing happen in your career this way?
I guess I'm schizoid. Looking to be who I am, which a great number of actors are, of course. I avoided comedy when I first came to California. The way to be discovered in those days was to guest star on an hour drama show and become the next leading man or whatever. And didn't really put my toe into the water of comedy until I went up to read for Mary Tyler Moore. I was afraid of it. Not that I couldn't do an initial spark of humor, but I didn't know how to maintain it. I was afraid of being able to maintain it.
When you did a lot of drama, primarily, if I recall, you had an opportunity to play a lot of villains. Did that pose a problem?
No, because I just played myself.
Are you saying you're a villainous character yourself?
Oh, I think we all fancy ourselves as deep-dyed in some respects. Okay. I'm no different in that respect. But actually, not that many villains. There were a few nice ones, but for the most part, it was the police captain, the police lieutenant, the staunch support character to the leading man.
Usually, in a form of authority, correct?
Right.
Okay. Your new television show, Thunder Alley, which is on ABC, it shows on Tuesday nights at 8:30. In this character, you play a retired race car driver, and again, it is a comedy, an ABC sitcom. How do you go about choosing the roles? For instance, how did you go about choosing this particular role?
Well, certainly I felt it was me, that it was a type of character that would be quite easy for me to step into the shoes of. I have to like the script. Being a wonderful character in a terrible script would not appeal to me, and the script appealed to me, and it felt that there were the seeds, the buds of a potentially charming comedy, and I think we've begun to approach that.
The show has had some growing pains. First of all, it's been bumped around the schedule, and it's been spread out over 2 years, and you've even had some cast changes, is that correct?
That's right.
Does that pose a problem? Does that make the road more difficult?
You're never able to relax. We changed the initial actress in the pilot and worked with Diane Venora. That didn't work out after about eight episodes. Then Robin Riker was brought in as the daughter. We also had a change of an executive producer who was very very talented, but seem to rub up against the network. And each time that happens, it makes you feel very strongly you're not out of the woods, you're not set, you're not prepared to roll because you don't have the full-fledged combination that people want from you.
Are you involved in the production of the television show beyond your role as the lead actor?
I offer my opinion. I mildly struggle because you don't have to struggle too hard with our very generous producers in the way a particular script may speak or tend. If I feel a pattern that I'm not happy with over a series of shows is not going the way I want my character developed, or if I feel that certain areas are not being paid attention to, then I'll talk about it and hopefully it'll be addressed.
Was there a difficulty with playing Lou Grant for so many years and then trying to do other things? Were people trying to typecast you in other Lou Grant-type roles?
They will typecast you no matter what happens, and I realize I do the same thing in observing other actors that I come to expect certain types of work from, and kind of rear back when I see them stepping out of that mold. But fortunately for me, my agent and I pursued contrasting roles as much as possible, trying to stretch whatever I represent as much as possible. That helped in gaining other casting beyond Lou Grant.
For a little while, you had a nice little role there as Marky Post's dad on Hearts of Fire.
Right. That was enjoyable.
That was fun to watch. Was there not a possibility of you becoming a regular on that particular show at the time?
Well, I think that they either ran out of material for me or they felt that I was like a 600-pound gorilla, perhaps, and would be crowding the two wonderful stars of that show, Marky and John Ritter, making it difficult to write for them. So they began to peter out in terms of writing for me, and since I was only a momentary, I was only on for about a year, had informed them that I would be leaving eventually to get my own series off the ground, they probably decided that they had spun out what they wanted from my character, and then began to soft pedal it.
In the new ABC sitcom, Thunder Alley, you play a grandfather, and you are surrounded by kids, and sometimes actors are concerned that they get lost in shows where kids are on. Did that not concern you?
It has, in a way, particularly when we were at the 8 o'clock slot, and they pushed very heavily to focus on the kids. But I must say that these are wonderful kids, very bright and very talented. And the producer and the network also want to make me happy. This is my first intense experience working with kids. I'm not saddled with getting the performance out of them. Robbie Benson, our director, or whoever's replacing him at the time, the assistant directors, the parents, even the teachers work very hard with the kids. So I'm spared a lot of that grunt work. And I get to enjoy the cream of them.
How is it different in this sitcom situation from the other two sitcom situations? As I mentioned, Hearts of Fire and, of course, the Mary Tyler Moore Show, where you are the focus of the show as opposed to being one of the supporting actors involved with the lead. Does that change? Does it make it more difficult for you? Is it a bigger challenge, or is it just the same as far as acting skills are concerned?
Well, bear in mind, I was not the focus on the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Exactly,
Mary
that's
was,
what I mean, yeah.
And a number of zanies that surrounded her.
Yeah.
Also, I was not the focus on Hearts of Fire.
That's my point exactly, that you're the focus on this particular program. It's a different sitcom situation than you've been in the past.
No, because, well, let's look right. I did a short-lived comedy series there called Off the Rack with Eileen Brennan.
Oh, of course, yes.
I was the focus there, and it is different. I guess it creates a mindset in you wherein if you're not heavy in 1 week or a couple of weeks, you're more patient. When you are a second or third banana, you start wondering how long will this trend keep up.
Let's go back to the Mary Tyler Moore Show for a little bit. When you first got that role, when you auditioned for the role, did you have any inkling, did anybody have any inkling that you were on the threshold of something, not, I can't say greatness, because who knows what that's going to be, but a show that definitely had a chance to run for a certain number of years and was looked like a hit from the start?
Well, it's one of the few times I have surmised correctly. When I got that script and read the character and read the script, I said, God, is this gold. This is the best thing I've read. Hector was a pup. And it doesn't matter what happens to it. The joy of being able to do this character in this script, it will be enough to satisfy me. And when I got it, and when we were guaranteed 13 on the air, most of the other actors were worried. Will we be picked up? Will we be picked up? And I had a wonderful out clause for myself. I just said, who cares? This is the best stuff I've ever done in television. And it gave me a great deal of security.
Did you originally audition for that particular role, or was there a possibility of other roles for you in that show? Because I know back just before Christmas, we had in studio with us one of your co-stars, Gavin McLeod, who was here doing a show, and he said that at one point he was even auditioning for the role of Lou Grant.
Well, that's right, and I think he even suggested that he would be more suited to Murray.
Exactly.
No, I only went up for Lou, and after going up for him, that's what I kept returning as.
How much of Lou is you, or vice versa?
Well, I used a lot of my brothers as Lou. They're wry, sardonic, twisted look types. And I kept digging into my ditty bag and envisioning my brothers a great deal of the time.
How much of an adjustment was it for you to go from Lou Grant, the comedic role, to Lou Grant, the dramatic role, with your hour-long series?
It was not only an enormously difficult adjustment for me, it was for everybody involved. Everybody thought that, because I asked that the two producers, Alan Burns and Jim Brooks of Mary Tyler Moore, be my producers on Lou Grant, and they were happy to do so, and it was their idea to expand it into an hour drama. And everybody at the MTM organization, none of them had ever really put out an hour drama show. And when we started, you know, I mean in terms of crew, in terms of executives, nobody knew what they were doing. And when we debuted on the air, CBS was even so nonplussed that they had us billed in TV Guide as Lou Grant, a comedy. I think the public was quite, you know, shocked, too, because I think when they tuned in on Lou Grant, they expected to see just another continuation of Mary Tyler Moore with the slightly different guys. And it took a while, a great long while, a year or two, for the public to adjust. And fortunately, CBS didn't have any instant replacement for us, and we won awards in the first year. And that gave us time to grow and really find our niche.
Speaking of awards, you have quite a few of them yourself. A lot of them for Lou Grant, or the character. You had, what, three Emmys on the Mary Tyler Moore Show?
Three on the Mary Tyler Moore Show and two on the Hour Show.
Did you ever anticipate that your mantle will look the way it does right now? You also have Golden Globes, I understand?
Right.
And how many Emmys total?
Seven.
Seven Emmys, and you have Golden Globes. Did you ever anticipate when you first started acting that this was where your career was going to take you?
No. The first night back on Mary Tyler Moore in the second year, I was waiting in the wings, having won my first Emmy with Gavin and Ted. And as they played the music for us to make our running entrance onto the stage, I looked at them and my heart was bursting, and I said, boy, I could die now. And they looked at me as if I was nuts, and they said, you go ahead, we have yet to win ours.
One of the things that also gets your name in the news is the fact that you are involved, or have been involved, in several causes and organizations, and have been very outspoken in certain regards to some things you've said in the past. And I'm just curious to know if that has ever gotten in your way as far as your acting career is concerned, because sometimes you get people out there, either some people in the audience or maybe the movers and shakers in Hollywood, who just want actors to be actors and nothing else.
That's quite true. And my presidency of the Screen Actors Guild, coupled with at the same time being on the one of the founding members of Medical Aid for El Salvador, created a conflict which eventually led to a good deal of controversy and, I think, achieved the cancellation of the Lou Grant Show.
The cancellation of the show itself?
Yeah.
And at a time when CBS could have probably used a hit, it seems to be rather harsh to do something like that and without realizing that, I mean, put it this way, Lou Grant was bringing in a certain amount of money to CBS.
Well, I feel the same way. We were still a prestigious show. It created demonstrations outside CBS and all that. But it was the 1982, the height of Reagan power. And I think it was primarily in the hands of William Paley,
former chairman of CBS,
the decision to cancel it.
Is there any hard feelings, or is that all water under the bridge now? Could you go back to CBS?
Oh, yeah. And I think I've done a show or two for CBS. I can't recall, but Oh, yeah.
Hearts of Fire was,
that's right,
was one. The other roles you've done, too, you also have had an opportunity to do made-for-television movies, miniseries, off-Broadway. Let's talk about the big screen. More and more you see actors making that jump from the big screen to the little screen. Would you like to do more, quote-unquote, major motion pictures, or is the role most important to you and not necessarily the venue it's shown on?
Well, that certainly remains true, but it doesn't mean that I wouldn't love to do movies. I still find resistance to putting me in movies.
Why do you think that is?
I'm not sure whether it's a combination of so much TV in my life or my recognition as Ed Asner so intensively that they're hesitant to hope to bury me within the wrappings of a character.
Well, that's kind of hard to do.
Much more afraid than they are on television.
I'm sorry?
They're much more afraid to cast me than they are on television.
With all that you've done and a certain amount of power and clout that you've achieved, is it not possible to go out there and create your own roles, as some people have done in the movie industry?
Oh, yeah, I must bow to the cleverness and the wit and wisdom of Mr. Stallone and Mr. Schwarzenegger and a few others who have been able to do that. I think it's that mentality of thinking of themselves as stars, and I have been able to incorporate that into prodigious work in creating a character and selling it. Also, I'm not a leading man, so would be a harder sell for me.
With reruns and cable channels out there, right now A&E, for instance, is showing Lou Grant. You can see Lou Grant every day. You can see Mary Tyler Moore someplace every day. Do you look back at those old shows? Can you, Alano, I know there are actors who can't watch themselves. Can you watch yourselves and think back of the fond memories of doing those shows? Or do you just look at them like we do, as an audience?
Oh, I certainly do that when I can. And I must say, I watch Mary Tyler Moore, and I'm amazed. I said, I tend to joke with people and say I like to watch the Mary Tyler Moore Show to improve my acting.
How does it feel to be in not only in a television show like that, which is considered probably one of the finest comedies ever to come down the pike, but also when people talk about the funniest episode of anything they've ever seen on television, they always come back to the Mary Tyler Moore episode of Chuckles the Clown.
And that's a story in itself. A number of people associated with the show did not have confidence in it. The actors loved it. And so when we got to work on it, and as we approached Friday night and the performance, we had a fairly aged crew on that. And with so many death jokes, we never got many laughs while we were in rehearsal all week on stage. We began to get a little nervous. And at our final run-through, the producers said, oh, we're in trouble because we're about 5-6 minutes short. And we may have to come back after a hiatus and shoot an added scene. And we thought the script and the story were perfect the way they were. We hated that thought, and I don't know who said it first, but they said, we just have to get out there and play the hell out of it, which we did in front of that audience. And for the first time in my life, when I laughed, I really tried to create the most intensive, loudest laugh and most continuous laugh. Kept pumping up the show with the energy and adrenaline of that type. And lo and behold, when we finished, the audience loved it. When we finished, we had stretched the show the requisite 5 or 6 minutes it needed.
It's a classic piece of comedy. I'm sure you must be very, very proud of that.
I am.
As with all the work you have done. Thank you. For...
I also want to thank you for hosting my son, who's in Montreal now, acting as creative consultant on the Hiroshima project that's shooting there.
Oh, with Robin Spry.
Right.
Yes. That's a big project here in Montreal.
That's right.
Ed, thank you for talking with us this evening.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Continued success in your career, and thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure.
That was the delightful Ed Asner from a conversation from May of 1995. Ed passed away on August 29th at the age of 91. He was working right up until the end. He has 6 acting credits that have already been released in 2021, and about 8 projects that are now in post-production, and he was slated to be part of almost a dozen projects that are currently in pre-production. Nobody could say that in his golden years, Ed Asner was slacking off. He will be missed. You're listening to the Stump File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a show that is heard on many fine radio stations, including WLSL LPFM in Dade City, Florida.
The Stump File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that puts a smile on your face and a skip in your step. Please avoid skipping if you are driving.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Professor Jay Van Bavel. He's the author of The Power of Us. Plus, Dr. John Huber is back on the program to talk about stress and mental health and how psychedelics can be used in the treatment. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way and much more Stump File news here on the Stump File program, which is heard everywhere for all your devices on everything from Spotify to iHeartRadio to Apple and Google Podcasts and just about anywhere you do your streaming. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? If you want to get caught for a crime, the best thing you can do is make your vehicle as suspicious looking as possible. In Utah, one person is in jail without bail after a handwritten license plate and other problems with a car on I-15 led to the discovery of a large amount of methamphetamine. A Utah Highway Patrol trooper first spotted the car with its handwritten license plate heading northbound on I-15 on August 28th. In addition to the homemade tag, the trooper noticed illegally dark tinting on the window, including over the third brake light in the rear window. After pulling over the vehicle, the trooper noticed possible signs of drug use, such as eyes that were glassy, bloodshot, and red. Plus, he had facial tremors and was sweating. A preliminary search of the vehicle uncovered two small packages of a white substance believed to be methamphetamine. In addition to the invalid license plate, UHP said the driver's California license was either suspended or revoked. Of course it was. They always are in these stories. The car did not have a valid registration, and further search of the vehicle uncovered three more large bundles of methamphetamine. In all, it added up to more than 7 pounds. The trooper arrested the driver, identified as 41-year-old Francisco Velasquez. Velasquez admitted to using meth and receiving $2,000 to haul the drugs. Okay, I'm going to blame the person who hired Velasquez and paid him $2,000 to haul the drugs in the first place. I mean, clearly he didn't do any due diligence in the interviewing process to see if this idiot was even capable of doing the job. Success in business requires decent hiring practices, people. Pay attention. Okay. You can sue for just about anything in the United States. In this case, a California man is suing a condominium after a trip and fall as a result of being scared by a bear in a dumpster.
We hit the jackpot!
According to USA Today, California resident John Donaldson was a tourist at a condo in Nevada in 2019 when he went to throw away a doggy bag in a dumpster. When he opened the lid of the garbage receptacle, he was startled by a bear inside.
Look, corn on a cob! T-bone! That's what I call a smorgasbord!
Running away from the large animal, Donaldson reportedly tripped, twisted his ankle, and landed on his back in the process. The bear ended up wandering the condo grounds for a few minutes before heading back to his home base in the woods.
Well, take the cobbler to go. Now I'm smarter than the average bear.
The man suffered a full tear of his Achilles tendon and spinal cord compression from the fall, which all required surgery. Donaldson has now filed a lawsuit against the condo and Nevada's waste management for a defective and malfunctioning dumpster. The lawsuit claims the condo owners knew for months about a defective latch on the dumpster and was required by law to have a wildlife-proof dumpster because of the bear problem in the area. Donaldson hopes to get $15,000 in damages. At press time, there's no word on if the bear is planning to countersue. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a 911 caller reported hearing gunshots and a scream, forcing three Tennessee schools to go on lockdown. And it was all because of a couple's gender reveal. Upon learning that they were having a boy, the dad-to-be fired celebratory rounds into the air, and the mom screamed out of excitement at around 1:30 p.m. A neighbor who heard the noises called 911, and officers put the schools on lockdown out of caution. Officers discovered it wasn't an active shooter, but instead a couple making a phone call to share their baby news with out-of-town relatives. The expectant dad, whose name wasn't listed in a news release, later faced a charge of unlawful discharging of a weapon within city limits, which is a misdemeanor. If your gender reveal party involves gunfire,
you might be a redneck.
And let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Jay Van Bavel is an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at New York University. He's also the author of The Power of Us, which explores the dynamics of shared social identities. Jay joins us via Skype from New York. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program. I wanted to have you on the program late last year when I saw you doing a television hit on a cable news channel, and you were too busy at that time, but you set us up with one of your PhD students, Annie Sternesco, who was great, by the way, so thank you very much for that. We were talking back then about conspiracy theories. So tell us about your book, and what was the impetus for creating this book, and who do you see your readers as being?
Great question. So our book is fundamentally about human psychology and how we think about ourselves. And so most people have a notion that the way we think about ourselves is, you know, as an individual, almost like the hero in our own story. What we try to make the case is that our notions of identity are a bit wrong. So it turns out that people have lots of identities. The quote we use is that we contain multitudes. So, you know, for me, I'm a New Yorker, but I'm also a Canadian. I'm a dad. I'm a professor. And depending on the situation, it triggers me to think about the world through those different identities. And so our book is really about what nudges people to think about different identities and the consequences of that for their behavior and actions.
Now, that's interesting because you say you're a New Yorker. You're also a Canadian. When did you leave Canada?
I left Canada. So I'm born in Canada in 1978, and I left in 2006 to move to Ohio. And then I've been living in New York for the last 11 years.
So this is interesting because we're talking about psychology. You know, New Yorkers have a certain type of personality that people generalize about. Canadians have a certain type of personality that people generalize about. How do you feel, from a psychological point of view, has your personality changed from being in Canada and going to New York?
Yes. At some level, it's changed a lot. I mean, I grew up not only in Canada, but in rural Alberta, a town of 2,000 people called Fox Creek, way up in the far north with no radio stations or movie theaters. And so now I live in Manhattan, which is probably the densest part of the whole continent. And, you know, going from one place to the other has been scary, and it's changed me. I mean, it's one of those things they say, it's as you go to another place and interact with different types of people, sometimes it actually tells you more about who you are than you knew before. You start to realize all the assumptions you had. And the other thing it does is it triggers an identity in you. So I'm now a New Yorker, but for a New Yorker, if I see somebody like walking down the street and I see a Canadian maple leaf, I immediately feel like an affinity for that person. So you're constantly on the lookout for other signs of people you connect with.
But as someone who studies psychology, do you recognize the changes that are taking place in you as they happen, or is this an afterthought?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the great things about being a researcher is that I'm looking around the world all the time, thinking about myself and trying to understand what's going on in my own head and other people's heads. And that's one of the things that, you know, spurs me to do new research projects. I will say one of the big things that got me studying American politics and partisanship was when I moved to Ohio, and it was the 2008 presidential election. And it just felt so different than Canada that I really wanted to understand what was going in the minds of all these people when they were like going to these rallies and getting excited about their political leaders.
Well, since we were talking a little bit about politics, again, when I wanted to speak to you last year, we were talking about the idea of cultish personalities and conspiracy theories and the like. Well, since that time has taken place, we have had events like January 6th. As a professor of psychology, what do you think of that situation? And is it something that you anticipated, knowing your background educationally, or is it something that was even a surprise to you?
So, yeah, the January 6th insurrection here was arguably the biggest threat to democracy, maybe in American history. And America's, I think, the world's oldest functioning democracy. So that says a lot. One of the things that, that I've been studying for the past few years is extremism and also misinformation and conspiracy theories. And I've been studying that for the last 5 years. And one of the big things that we're finding is that, the way when we normally think about conspiracy theorists, we normally think about someone in a basement on a computer too much wearing a tinfoil hat. And so there are these people that just believe the earth is flat and Diane's murder or death was, a conspiracy theory, or 9/11 was an inside job. But what we're finding is another big driver of conspiracy theory beliefs is identity. So once you get really identified with a political party, for example, it tunes you into certain types of information and websites, and you trust certain types of leaders, and you're more likely to kind of buy into any conspiracy theory floating around that aligns with that identity. You become less skeptical of bad information. And once you absorb a conspiracy theory, the other thing, it's just kind of like baked into the DNA of what a conspiracy theory is, means it's really hard to debunk, because part of every conspiracy theory is that there's a bunch of powerful people working against you, conspiring against you. And so if, some expert on the news comes to challenge and tell you, that's not right, that's wrong, that can be seen as part of the conspiracy. So that's kind of what we're dealing with now with many people who believe the election was stolen in the United States. Just seeing it fact-checked over and over again on the news is not helping at all.
When I spoke to Annie last year, I think I asked her a question, and that is, when it comes to conspiracy theories, is part of the problem that when something horrific happens, like the killing of John F. Kennedy, or 9/11, or any other big item, that some people just can't wrap their heads around it, so they welcome in a conspiracy theory because it helps to soften the explanation as to what could possibly have taken place?
Yeah, I mean, conspiracy theories are people putting a bunch of dots together to make sense of something that's confusing. And I will say, during elections, or especially now during the pandemic, there's a lot of uncertainty. The situation is quite dangerous. People are looking to make sense of all of that in their own way through their life. And now with the internet and social media, you can kind of find almost any evidence for any belief system that you want with the right search words and following the right people. So it allows people to really go down this rabbit hole and also tap into a community of like-minded others. And what the research shows with cults that we talk about in our book is, even when a cult is proven wrong, people will stick with it sometimes, in part because the other people and the social belonging they get and the reinforcement they get from other members of the cult keeps them believing or allows them to kind of stick with their beliefs even if it's proven wrong. And so that's essentially what you have in certain conspiracy theory groups and political communities.
You mentioned the internet. As someone who studies this, does it concern you that things could possibly get worse?
Yeah, I mean, there's almost 4 billion people around the world now with social media profiles. And the average social media user scrolls through about 300 feet of news feed a day on their social media. So that means if you hold up your phone right now, if you're listening to this, and let's say it's about 6 inches tall, that means you swiped up 600 times in a day. That's the height of the Statue of Liberty. That's how much news you saw. And so when you're filtering all that information, you're looking to kind of engage with and read more deeply and share the things that kind of matter to you the most, the things that pop out. And so the things that pop out in that, you know, attention economy, that fight for your attention and engagement, are often things that are really morally and emotionally laden. So like very hyper partisan rhetoric, conspiracy theories, things like that kind of grab your attention more. And that's the things you're more likely to click on or share.
I always believe that education, actual education and critical thinking is one way to combat conspiracy theories and for lack of a better term, odd thinking. But let me play devil's advocate for a moment. I'm sure you must have heard of people who say, well, you know, it's what's going on in the universities these days that's what's leading to these people becoming sheep and believing these things that they shouldn't be believing.
Yeah, so I think you're right that, and there's lots of research suggesting that education can make you skilled at like evaluating evidence, and then you know how to do a proper, you know, background search or fact check on your own. So that does help, but it's not a perfect way to solve it. And especially if people don't trust universities or colleges, which they don't. Some people in society don't right now, and in a way, that kind of rhetoric, there's good reasons to criticize universities and colleges or the media. But a lot of that rhetoric actually reminds me of the rhetoric of cult leaders that try to cut you off from your family, or they call them suppressive individuals, people who question the cult. And so when people are trying to convince you not to get educated or convince you not to go to college or university because they don't trust them, or convince you not to read high-quality media sources, because they can't trust them, what they're doing is isolating you from other sources of high quality information, and they're making it more likely that you're dependent on them for your beliefs. And so we have to understand that when people are trying to, you know, and it's a form of propaganda to convince you not to get access to this better quality information or education, that they're effectively cutting you off from it.
Well, it's a fascinating topic and a fascinating study that you are currently working on. And the book, again, is called The Power of Us. Jay, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter. I hope people have a chance to pick up the book and enjoy it.
Jay Von Bavel, author of The Power of Us. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0629. And you can find links to Jay's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a show that is heard on many fine radio stations, including Gold 90.5 FM in Singapore.
This is The Stuff File.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of The Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come in the program, we will talk to Dr. John Huber. As a matter of fact, we'll do that in just a matter of seconds. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way, but we don't have any more time for Stuff File news here on a program that is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. So let's get right to the guest, shall we? There's the old adage of, may you live in interesting times, but apparently, the interesting times we live in comes with a cost. From global warming to pandemics to political divide, the last 18 months or so have been, for some, a stress-releasing tsunami of emotions. To talk about it, we welcome back clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber. He is the CEO of TripSitter Clinic, and he joins us via Skype from Texas. Hi, John.
How are you?
Having a great day, Peter. Thanks for having me on.
I'm just tickety-boo, John. Just tickety-boo. Without making light of the situation, it must be a bumper time for your business.
Well, we have ups and downs. Part of the problem right now, though, is the whole COVID and the 6-foot restrictions and things like that. And a lot of people are struggling with finding therapists and being able to go online and do psychotherapy online. So that's why, I move forward with TripSitter.clinic, and we are providing online mental health services. And we've just had to make an evolutionary change. The traditional brick and mortar wasn't cutting it anymore. And now we're 100% virtual.
What in the things that I mentioned in the introduction, what besides COVID, or is it just COVID? And the reason why I wanted to call you is because it's like layer upon layer of issues to stress people out have been added to our daily lives. And I'm sure one of the most recent things is, quite frankly, the situation that has taken place in Afghanistan and all that that has wrought, and the future of concerning one about terrorism and the like. It's a never-ending situation of situations.
It's the human condition. Unfortunately, part of the human condition is that we're social animals, and that's how our brains actually help regulate our neurotransmitters, is actually with connections of other human beings. I mean, that's why the Geneva Convention, now it's supposed to be some kind of war crime for, isolation and keeping prisoners away from everybody else. Because of the neurological, neurochemical things that happen that create stress. Now, so all these other things that normally happen, we've always been engaged in some kind of military movement, altercation, war. Just about every country has some kind of ongoing economic or social issues that are going on. And now we've got one of the things that always helped us maintain our sanity, for lack of a better word, and that is our interactions with our friends and our family. And it becomes very difficult when we don't have access to that. And it's a struggle. It makes things more intense, more difficult to handle. And if we look at pre-COVID, here in the U.S., we assumed that roughly 1 in 5 people, or 20%, have mental health issues. And during COVID, at this point, the CDC is suggesting it's over 50%, maybe pushing 55%. So that's pretty intense.
Wow. Now, you mentioned the isolation factor. We, of course, now have social media to contend with. I'm sure there are pros and cons there. Is it a help or a hindrance?
It can be a help if you're actually doing something like we're doing, Skyping, and you're seeing your friends and stuff like that. The problem is, most social media, we filter and we just show the world how perfect our life is. So somebody who's struggling and they see all your pictures on the beach and, out fishing and having a good time and all this kind of stuff, and they're isolated and they're stuck maybe in, behind 6 or 8 feet of snow, and they're just made much more worse by the fact that everybody else is having a good time and I'm stuck and I'm not. So you have to realize, though, that all that stuff is being filtered. You don't see that maybe they're out fishing because they lost their job. They're not telling you about losing the job. They're not telling you about having to get a second mortgage to take that trip to Tahiti. You're just seeing the fun part, and that's all they're painting for you is that picture.
Well, maybe I'm just a different beast because, the idea of being isolated behind 6 to 8 feet of snow is just heaven to me. I don't know what the problem is with that.
Well, there's always outliers.
Yeah. You know,
there's always outliers. That's what makes the world go round. That's what makes my job so interesting, is we get these people who just don't fit the mold. And that's the spice that makes life interesting for me. So, you are an unusual person in that effect. But, also you sit back and, you're so well grounded. You actually do interact with a lot of human beings like myself. I mean, doing what you do, you're actually making that human connection, even though you're physically isolated. And you've been doing this for a while. It wasn't just COVID. I mean, I remember our earlier, discussions over the years, and you love what you do. So you're getting your neurochemical nutrition met. Not everybody has that ability.
And that leads into another question. Do you think that maybe, is it part of what you do to find out when you come across someone as a patient, to find out where their comfort zone or their sweet spot might be and lead them toward that, because maybe they're just not aware of where that direction should take them?
Well, when you talk about that, a lot of times, you know, the comfort zone for people who are struggling with mental health issues oftentimes is maladaptive. So I don't necessarily want them to be comfortable. I may be looking at as a personal growth for my patient. You know, I need to get them stimulated and willing to move forward. So probably the most important thing in that situation with that person is to build an appropriate therapeutic relationship with that person that I can challenge them and threaten them on one level, but at the same level, they also know that I'm doing it trying to help them, and I'm not trying to beat them up and manipulate them. I'm actually trying to do what they're asking me for help for. And that is where you need a skilled clinician, and talking to your best friend isn't necessarily going to do that.
Okay, so since you say that some of them might have inadequate or incorrect comfort zones, do you try to guide them towards new ones?
Absolutely. But first, I have to have that therapeutic relationship where I can get them to challenge their maladaptive belief set or behavior set. That is exactly where we want to take it. We want them to challenge that. And maybe we start with baby steps. I mean, it's a simple little thing if you're doing okay to make those changes. But if you're really anxious, really depressed, or suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, you're first of all not thinking clearly. So there's a lot of hurdles to overcome. And that's where I think tripsitter.clinic helps out, because we capitalize on low dose use of ketamine, because now it allows people to lower their self-defense mechanisms. So now we can get in there therapeutically and work on things that they're not trying to stop, because they've allowed us to kind of disinhibit their defense mechanisms for a 30 or 45 minute window.
Those who have listened to this program over the years and have heard you on before have not heard the term or the company TripSitter. So in the few moments we have left, tell us about TripSitter and how this came to be.
Because of COVID, most of my patients stopped coming into the office and doing therapy. And I worked with an older generation. They weren't comfortable using Skype or Zoom or anything else like that. So, you know, I had to restructure my whole business model. And in doing so, the best model out there that we had was online talk therapy. But that is such a deficient thing. You know, I talked about that relationship we have to build. It's so much more difficult to do that over online service than in person. So I looked for the next best thing. And I'd been using ketamine-assisted psychotherapy in my office with some amazing doctors in my community, because it is a medication I have to work with medical doctors in the process. And it becomes very expensive. So my goal was to find a way to lower the expense and increase the opportunity for everyday person. Now, to get you to understand, in a brick and mortar, the cost is anywhere from $500 to $1,600 a session for ketamine. We're able to get you with a physician. They meet with you, they write a treatment plan, and we give you oral doses, which we ship to you. And then you can, depending upon your physician's treatment plan that you two work out together based on your condition and your work experience and other things that are going on in your life, you can have a treatment up to once to four times a week with oral ketamine. And it's all for less than $400 for the whole thing. So that's for the whole month. Now, oral administration is a little slower. And what ketamine does is it allows new neural pathways to develop and things like that. So it's not an overnight, I give you a pill and you're happy tomorrow kind of a thing. It takes time. It takes a couple months through this process for you to snap out of essentially your funk that you're in, because what's happening is your brain is creating new pathways. And in some instances, that the research suggests actually new brain cells that your brain then can utilize to help stabilize your mental health issues. It's a process. It's not a switch. Okay. So our treatment plans, the minimum treatment plan is 3 months. you know, we're being relatively successful. You know, in the brick and mortars that I work, we're about 80% successful in brick and mortar. When we add psychotherapy onto that, it drops up into the, or runs up into the low 90s, which is significant when you consider some of my patients may have been in psychotherapy for 4 or 5 years, and we go in and in 6 or 8 weeks, they've come to a solution and they're no longer suffering from their post-traumatic stress disorder, for example. So you may think 3 months is a long time, but in the scope of things, if you've been suffering for 20 years, a psychoanalyst will tell you it's going to take you 20 years to get out of that. I'm here to tell you it's going to take you 3 to 6 months if you follow our treatment regime.
And for more information, people can go to the website, which is tripsitter.clinic, correct?
Absolutely. That is correct.
John, thank you once again for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter. Have an amazing day.
Dr. John Huber, CEO of Tripsitter Clinic. You can go to my website at thestumpfile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0629, and you'll find links to John's site. You're listening to The Stump File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a show that is heard on many fine radio stations, including CFMH-FM, Local 107.3 FM in St. John, New Brunswick. Well, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
This one is short and sweet, so before we get to it, we should reaffirm some major ground rules that I'm sure most of you already know. If you only have your learner's permit to drive, you know that you must be extra cautious, stay within the speed limit, keep your hands at 10 and 2 on the wheel, and don't do anything to anger pedestrians, other drivers, or the cops. With that knowledge, let's move on. In the UK, a learner driver had their car confiscated after making offensive hand gestures at an unmarked police car. Kent Police's Swale team posted on Twitter after stopping the driver and finding they only had a provisional license. The team explained the car was seized and the driver had to make their way home on foot. Oh, I wonder how he's going to explain this to his parents. Because why? Oh, why? Would you be out on the road with a learner's permit flipping the bird to police officers? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0629. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0629. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including the podcast station, cyberstationusa.com, kdxradio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, truetalkradio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW FM in Winnipeg, and CFMU in Hamilton. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.